upon your chair to catch a glimpse of the sun, averting your eyes from the mounds of rubble. My greatest pleasure has been in resuming my evening walks along the clifftops. The channel is no longer framed in rolls of barbed wire. The view is unbroken by huge verboten signs. The mines are gone from our beaches, and I can walk when, where, and for as long as I like. If I stand on the cliffs and turn out to face the sea, I don't see the ugly cement bunkers behind me, or the land naked without its trees. Not even the Germans could ruin the sea. This summer, gorse will begin to grow around the fortifications, and by next year perhaps vines will creep over them. I hope they are soon covered. For all I can look away, I will never be able to forget how they were made. The tote workers built them. I know you have heard of Germany's slave workers in camps on the continent, but did you know that Hitler sent over 16,000 of them here, to the Channel Islands? Hitler was fanatic about fortifying these islands. England was never to get them back. His generals called it island madness. He ordered large gun emplacements, anti-tank walls on the beaches, hundreds of bunkers and batteries, arms and bomb depots, miles and miles of underground tunnels, a huge underground hospital, and a railroad to cross the island to carry materials. The coastal fortifications were absurd. The Channel Isles were better fortified than the Atlantic Wall built against an Allied invasion. The installations jutted out over every bay. The Third Reich was to last 1,000 years in concrete. So, of course, he needed thousands of slave workers. Men and boys were conscripted. Some were arrested, and some were just picked up off the streets, out of cinema queues, from cafes, from the country lanes and fields of any German-occupied territory. There were even political prisoners from the Spanish Civil War. The Russian prisoners of war were treated the worst, perhaps because of their victory over the Germans on the Russian front. Most of these slave workers came to the islands in 1942. They were kept in open sheds, dug out tunnels, in pens, some of them in houses. They were marched all over the island to their work sites, thin to the bone, dressed in ragged trousers with bare skin showing through, often no coats to protect them from the cold, no shoes or boots, their feet tied up in bloody rags. Young lads, 15 and 16, were so weary and starved they could scarcely put one foot in front of another. Guernsey Islanders would stand by their gates to offer them what little food or warm clothing they could spare. Sometimes the Germans guarding the tote work columns would let the men break ranks to accept these gifts. Other times they would beat them to the ground with rifle butts. Thousands of those men and boys died here. And I have recently learned that their inhuman treatment was the intended policy of Himmler. He called his plan death by exhaustion, and he implemented it. Work them hard. Don't waste valuable foodstuffs on them, and let them die. They could and would always be replaced by new slave workers from Europe's occupied countries. Some of the tote workers were kept down on the common behind a wire fence. They were white as ghosts, covered in cement dust. There was only one water standpipe for over 100 men to wash themselves. Children sometimes went down to the green to see the tote workers behind the wire fences. They would poke walnuts and apples, sometimes potatoes, through the wire for them. There was one tote worker who did not take the food. He came to see the children. He would put his arm through the wire just to hold their faces in his hands, to touch their hair. The Germans did give the tote workers one half day a week off, on Sunday. That was the day when the German sanitary engineers emptied all the sewage into the ocean, by way of a big pipe. Fish would swarm for the offal, and the tote workers would stand in that feces and filth up to their chests, trying to catch the fish in their hands to eat them. No flowers or vines can cover over such memories as these, can they? I have told you the most hateful story of the war. Juliet, Isola thinks you should come and write a book about the German occupation. She told me she did not have the skill to write such a book herself, but, as dear as Isola is to me, I am terrified she might buy a notebook and begin anyway. Yours ever, Amelia Morgery.
From Juliet to Dorsey, 11th of April, 1946. Dear Mr. Adams, after promising never to write to me again, Adelaide Addison has sent me another letter. It is devoted to all the people and practices she deplores, and you are one of them, along with Charles Lamb. It seems she called on you to deliver the April issue of the Parish Magazine, and you were nowhere to be found. Not milking your cow, not hoeing your garden, not washing your house, not doing anything a good farmer should be doing. So she entered your barnyard, and lo, what did she see? You, lying up in your hayloft, reading a book by Charles Lamb. You were so enraptured with that drunkard, you failed to notice her presence. What a blight that woman is. Do you happen to know why? I lean toward a malignant fairy at her christening. In any event, the picture of you lolling in the hay, reading Charles Lamb, pleased me very much. It made me recall my own childhood in Suffolk. My father was a farmer there, and I helped out at the farm. Though, admittedly, all I did was jump out of our car, open the gate, close it, and jump back in, gather eggs, weed our garden, and flail at the hay when I was in the mood. I remember lying in our hayloft reading The Secret Garden, with a cowbell beside me. I'd read for an hour and then ring the bell for a glass of lemonade to be brought to me. Mrs. Hutchins, the cook, finally grew weary of this arrangement and told my mother, and that was the end of my cowbell, but not my reading in the hay. Mr. Hastings found the E.V. Lucas biography of Charles Lamb. He decided not to quote a price to you, but just to send it along to you at once. He said, "A lover of Charles Lamb ought not to have to wait. Yours ever, Juliet Ashton."
From Susan Scott to Sydney, 11th of April, 1946. Dear Sydney, I'm as tender-hearted as the next girl, but damn it, if you don't get back here soon, Charlie Stevens is going to have a nervous breakdown. He's not cut out for work. He's cut out for handing over large wads of cash and letting you do the work. He actually turned up at the office before 10 o'clock yesterday, but the effort annihilated him. He was deathly white by 11, and had a whiskey at 11:30. At noon, one of the innocent young things handed him a jacket to approve. His eyes bulged with terror, and he began that disgusting trick with his ear. He's going to pull it right off one day. He went home at 1, and I haven't seen him yet today. It's 4 in the afternoon. In other depressing developments, Harriet Mumfries has gone completely berserk. She wants to colour-coordinate the entire children's list. Pink and red. I kid you not. The boy in the mailroom, I don't bother learning their names any more, got drunk and threw away all letters addressed to anyone whose name started with an S. Don't ask why. Miss Tilly was so impossibly rude to Kendrick that he tried to hit her with her telephone. I can't say I blame him, but telephones are hard to come by, and we can't afford to lose one. You must sack her the minute you come home. If you need any further inducement to buy an aeroplane ticket, I can also tell you that I saw Juliet and Mark Reynolds looking very cosy at Café de Paris the other night. Their table was behind the velvet cordon, but from my seat in the slums, I could spy all the telltale signs of romance, he murmuring little nothings in her ear, her hand lingering in his beside the cocktail glasses, his touching her shoulder to point out an acquaintance. I considered it my duty, as your devoted employee, to break it up, so I elbowed my way past the cordon to say hello to Juliet. She seemed delighted and invited me to join them, but it was apparent from Mark's smile that he didn't want company, so I retreated. He's not a man to cross that one, with his thin smile, no matter how beautiful his ties are, and it would break my mum's heart if my lifeless body was found bobbing in the Thames. In other words, get a wheelchair, get a crutch, get a donkey to tote you, but come home now. Yours, Susan.
From Juliet to Sydney and Piers, 12th of April, 1946. Dear Sydney and Piers, I've been ransacking the libraries of London for background on Guernsey. I even got a ticket to the reading room, which shows my devotion to duty. As you know, I'm petrified of the place. I found out quite a lot. Do you recall a wretched, goofy series of books in the 1920s called A Tramp in Skye, or A Tramp in Lindisfarne, or in Sheepholm, or whatever port the author happened to sail his yacht into? Well, in 1930, he sailed into St. Peterport, Guernsey, and wrote a book about it, with day trips to Sark, Herm, Alderney and Jersey, where he was mauled by a duck and had to return home. Tramp's real name was C.C. Meredith. He was an idiot who thought he was a poet, and he was rich enough to sail anywhere, then write about it, then have it privately printed, and then give a copy to any friend who would take it. C.C. didn't trouble himself with dull fact. He preferred to scamper off to the nearest moor, beach, or flowery field, and go into transports with his muse. But bless him anyhow, his book, A Tramp in Guernsey, was just what I needed to get the feel of the island. C.C. went ashore at St. Peterport, leaving his mother, Dorothea, to bob about the adjacent waters, retching in the wheelhouse. In Guernsey, C.C. wrote poems to the freesias and the daffodils, also to the tomatoes. He was agog with admiration for the Guernsey cows and the blooded bulls, and he composed a little song in honour of their cowbells. Tinkle, tinkle, such a merry sound. Directly beneath the cows, in Cece's estimation, were the simple folk of the country parishes who still speak the Norman patois and believe in fairies and witches. Cece entered into the spirit of the thing and saw a fairy in the gloaming. After carrying on about the cottages and the hedgerows and the shops, Cece at last reached the sea, or, as he has it, the sea. It is everywhere. The waters, azure, emerald, silver-laced, when they are not as hard and dark as a bag of nails. Thank God Tramp had a co-author, Dorothea, who was made of sterner stuff, and loathed Guernsey and everything about it. She was in charge of delivering the history of the island, and she was not one to gild the lily. As to Guernsey's history, well, the least said, soonest mended. The islands once belonged to the Duchy of Normandy, but when William, Duke of Normandy, became William the Conqueror, he took the Channel Islands along with him in his back pocket, and he gave them to England, with special privileges. These privileges were later increased by King John and added to yet again by Edward III. Why? What did they do to deserve the preference? Nary a thing. Later, when that weakling Henry VI managed to lose most of France back to the French, the Channel Islands elected to stay a crown possession of England, as who would not? The Channel Islands freely owe their allegiance and love to the English crown. But heed this, dear reader.
The Crown cannot make them do anything they do not want to do. Guernsey's ruling body, such as it is named the States of Deliberation, but called the States for short. The real head of everything is the President of the States, who is elected by the States, and called the Bailiff. In fact, everyone is elected, not appointed by the King. Pray, what is a monarch for, if not to appoint people to things? The Crown's only representative to this unholy melange is the Lieutenant Governor. While he is welcome to attend the meetings of the States, and he may talk and advise all he wants, he does not have a vote. At least he is allowed to live in Government House, the only mansion of any note on Guernsey, if you don't count Saumarez Manor, which I don't. The Crown cannot impose taxes on the islands, or conscription. Honesty forces me to admit the islanders don't need conscription to make them go to war for dear, dear England. They volunteered and made very respectable, even heroic, soldiers and sailors against Napoleon and the Kaiser. But be advised, these selfless acts do not make amends for the fact that the Channel Islands pay no income tax to England, not one shilling. It makes one want to spit. Those are her kindest words. I will spare you the rest, but you get her general drift. One, or better yet, both of you write to me. I want to hear how both the patient and the nurse are doing. What does your doctor say about your leg, Sydney? I swear you've had time to grow a new one. Kiss, 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 Juliet.
From Darcy to Juliet, the 15th of April, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I don't know what ails Adelaide Addison. Isola says she is a blight because she likes being a blight. It gives her a sense of destiny. Adelaide did me one good turn, though, didn't she? She told you, better than I could, how much I was enjoying Charles Lamb. The biography came. I've read fast, too impatient not to. But I'll go back and start over again, reading more slowly this time, so I can take everything in. I did like what Mr. Lucas said about him. He could make any homely and familiar thing into something fresh and beautiful. Lamb's writings make me feel more at home in his London than I do here and now in St. Peterport. But what I cannot imagine is Charles coming home from work and finding his mother stabbed to death, his father bleeding, and his sister Mary standing over both with a bloody knife. How did he make himself go into the room and take the knife away from her? After the police had taken her off to the madhouse, how did he persuade the judge in court to release her to his care and his care alone? He was only 21 years old then. How did he talk them into it? He promised to take care of Mary for the rest of her life, and once he put his foot on that road, he never stepped off it. It is sad he had to quit writing poetry, which he loved, and instead write criticism and essays, which he did not honour much, to make money. I think of all his life, working as a clerk at the East India Company, so he could save money for the day, and it always came, when Mary would grow mad again, and he would have to place her in a private home. And even then he did seem to miss her. They were such friends. Picture them. He had to watch her like a hawk for the awful symptoms, and she herself could tell when the madness was coming on, and could do nothing to stop its coming. That must have been worst of all. I imagine him sitting there, watching her on the sly, and her sitting there, watching him watching her. How they must have hated the way the other one was forced to live. But doesn't it seem to you that when Mary was sane, there was no one saner or better company? Charles certainly thought so, and so did all their friends. Wordsworth, Hazlitt, Leigh Hunt, and above all Coleridge. On the day Coleridge died, they found a note he had scribbled in the book he was reading. It said, "Charles and Mary Lamb, dear to my heart, yes, as it were, my heart." Perhaps I've written overlong about him, but I wanted you and Mr. Hastings to know how much your books have given me to think about, and the pleasure I find in them. I like the story from your childhood, The Bell and the Hay. I can see it in my mind. Did you like living on a farm? Do you ever miss it? You are never really away from the countryside in Guernsey, not even in St. Peterport, so I cannot imagine the difference living in a big city like London would make. Kit has taken against mongooses, now she knows they eat snakes. She is hoping to find a boa constrictor under a rock. Isola stopped by this evening and said to tell you hello. She will write to you as soon as she gets her crops in. Rosemary, dill, thyme, and henbane. Yours, Dawsey Adams.
From Juliet to Dawsey, 18th of April, 1946. Dear Dawsey, I am so glad you want to talk about Charles Lamb on paper. I have always thought Mary's sorrow made Charles into a great writer, even if he had to give up poetry and clerk for the East India Company because of it. He had a genius for sympathy that not one of his great friends could touch. When Wordsworth chided him for not caring enough about nature, Charles wrote, "I have no passion for groves and valleys. The rooms where I was born, the furniture which has been before my eyes all my life, a bookcase which has followed me about like a faithful dog wherever I have moved. Old chairs, old streets, squares where I have sunned myself, my old school. Have I not enough without your mountains? I do not envy you. I should pity you, did I not know that the mind will make friends of anything. A mind that can make friends of anything. I thought of that often during the war. By chance, I came upon another story about him today. He often drank too much, far too much, but he was not a sullen drunk. Once, his host's butler had to carry him home, slung over his shoulder in a fireman's hold. The next day, Charles wrote his host such a hilarious note of apology, the man bequeathed it to his son in his will. I hope Charles wrote the butler, too. Have you ever noticed that when your mind is awakened or drawn to someone new, that person's name suddenly pops up everywhere you go? My friend Sophie calls it coincidence, and Mr. Simplice, my parson friend, calls it grace. He thinks that if one cares deeply about someone or something new, one throws a kind of energy out into the world, and fruitfulness is drawn in. Yours ever, Juliet.
From Isola to Juliet, 18th of April, 1946. Dear Juliet, now that we are corresponding friends, I want to ask you some questions. They are highly personal. Dawsey said it would not be polite, but I see that's a difference twixt men and women, not polite and rude. Dawsey's never asked me a personal question in 15 years. I'd take it kindly if he would, but Dawsey's got quiet ways. I don't expect to change him, nor myself either. I see it that you care to know about us, so I guess you would like us to know about you, only you just didn't happen to think of it first. First of all, I saw a picture of you on the dust jacket of your book about Anne Bronte, so I know you are below 40 years of age. How far below? Was the sun in your eyes, or does it happen that you have a squint? Is it permanent? It must have been a windy day because your curls are blowing all about. I couldn't quite make out the colour of your hair, though I can tell it isn't blonde, for which I am glad. I don't like blondes very much. Do you live by the river? I hope so, because people who live near running water are much nicer than people who don't. I'd be mean as a scorpion if I lived inland. Do you have a serious suitor? I do not. Is your flat cosy or grand? Be fulsome, as I want to be able to picture it in my mind. Do you think you would like to visit us on Guernsey? Do you have a pet? What kind? Your friend, Isola.
From Juliet to Isola. 20th of April, 1946. Dear Isola, I am glad you want to know more about me, and am only sorry I didn't think of it myself, and sooner. Present day first. I am 33 years old, and you are right, the sun was in my eyes. In a good mood, I call my hair chestnut with gold glints. In a bad mood, I call it mousy brown.
It wasn't a windy day. My hair always looks that way. Naturally curly hair is a curse, and don't ever let anyone tell you different. My eyes are hazel. While I am slender, I am not tall enough to suit me. I don't live by the Thames anymore, and that is what I miss the most about my old home. I loved the sight and sound of the river at all hours. I live now in a borrowed flat in Glebe Place. It is small and furnished within an inch of its life, and the flat owner won't be back from the United States until November, so I have the run of his house until then. I wish I had a dog, but the building management does not allow pets. The Kensington Gardens aren't so very far, so if I begin to feel cooped up, I can walk to the park, rent a deck chair for a shilling, loll about under the trees, watch the passers-by and children play, and I am soothed, somewhat. 81 Oakley Street was demolished by a random V1 just over a year ago. Most of the damage was to the row of houses behind mine, but three floors of number 81 were sheared off, and my flat is now a pile of rubble. I hope Mr. Grant, the owner, will rebuild, for I want my flat, or a facsimile of it, back again, just as it was, with Cheyne Walk and the river outside my windows. Luckily, I was away in Bury when the V1 hit. Sydney Stark, my friend and now publisher, met my train that evening and took me home, and we viewed the huge mountain of rubble and what was left of the building. With part of the wall gone, I could see my shredded curtains waving in the breeze, and my desk, three-legged and slumped on the slanting floor that was left. My books were a muddy, sopping pile, and although I could see my mother's portrait on the wall, half gouged out and sooty, there was no safe way to recover it. The only intact possession left was my large crystal paperweight, with Carpe Diem carved across its top. It had belonged to my father, and there it sat, whole and unchipped, atop a pile of broken bricks and splintered wood. I could not do without it, so Sydney clambered over the rubble and retrieved it for me. I was a fairly nice child, until my parents died when I was 12. I left our farm in Suffolk and went to live with my great-uncle in London. I was a furious, bitter, morose little girl. I ran away twice, causing my uncle no end of trouble, and at the time I was very glad to do so. I am ashamed now when I think about how I treated him. He died when I was 17, so I was never able to apologize. When I was 13, my uncle decided I should go away to boarding school. I went, mulish as usual, and met the headmistress, who marched me into the dining room. She led me to a table with four other girls. I sat, arms crossed, hands tucked under my armpits, glaring like a molting eagle, looking around for someone to hate. I hit upon Sophie Stark, Sydney's younger sister. Perfect. She had golden curls, big blue eyes, and a sweet, sweet smile. She made an effort to talk with me. I didn't answer until she said, "I hope you will be happy here." I told her I wouldn't be staying long enough to find out. "As soon as I find out about the trains, I am gone," said I. That night, I climbed out onto the dormitory roof, meaning to sit there and have a good brood in the dark. In a few minutes, Sophie crawled out, with a railway timetable for me. Needless to say, I never ran away. I stayed, with Sophie as my new friend. Her mother would often invite me to their house for holidays, which was where I met Sydney. He was 10 years older than me, and was, of course, a god. He later changed into a bossy older brother, and later still, one of my dearest friends. Sophie and I left school and, wanting no more of academic life, but life instead, we went to London and shared rooms Sydney had found for us. We worked together for a while in a bookshop, and I wrote, and threw away, stories at night. Then the Daily Mirror sponsored an essay contest. 500 words on what women fear most. I knew what the Mirror was finagling for, but I'm far more afraid of chickens than I am of men, so I wrote about that. The judges, thrilled at not having to read another word about sex, awarded me first prize. £5, and I was, at last, in print. The Daily Mirror received so many fan letters, they commissioned me to write an article, then another one. I soon began to write feature stories for other newspapers and magazines. Then the war broke out, and I was invited to write a semi-weekly column for The Spectator, called Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War. Sophie met and fell in love with an airman, Alexander Strachan. They married, and Sophie moved to his family's farm in Scotland. I am godmother to their son, Dominic, and though I haven't taught him any hymns, we did pull the hinges off his cellar door last time I saw him. It was a Pictish ambush. I suppose I do have a suitor, but I'm not really used to him yet. He's terribly charming, and he plies me with delicious meals. But I sometimes think I prefer suitors in books rather than right in front of me. How awful, backward, cowardly, and mentally warped that will be if it turns out to be true. Sydney published a book of my Izzy Bickerstaff columns, and I went on a book tour. And then I began writing letters to strangers in Guernsey, now friends, whom I would indeed like to come and see. Yours ever, Juliet.
From Eli to Juliet, 21st of April 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, thank you for the blocks of wood. They are beautiful. I could not believe what I saw when I opened your box. All those sizes and shades from pale to dark. How did you happen to find the different kinds and shapes of wood? You must have gone to so many places to find them all. I'll bet you did, and I don't know how to thank you for that. They came at just the right time, too. Kit's favourite animal was a snake she saw in a book, and he was easy to carve, being so long and thin. Now she's gone on ferrets. She says she won't ever touch my whittling knife again if I'll carve her a ferret. I don't think it will be too hard to make one, for they are pointy too. Because of your gift, I have wood to practice with. Is there an animal you would like to have? I want to carve a present for you, but I'd like it to be something you'd favour. Would you like a mouse? I am good with mice. Yours truly, Eli. From Eben to Juliet, 22nd of April, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, your box for Eli came Friday. What a kindness of you. He sits and studies the blocks of wood, as if he sees something hidden inside them, and he can make it come out with his knife. You asked if all the Guernsey children were evacuated to England. No, some stayed, and when I missed Eli, I looked at the little ones around me and was glad he had gone. The children here had a bad time, for there was no food to grow on. I remember picking up Bill Lapel's boy. He was 12, but weighed no more than a child of 7. It was a terrible thing to decide. Send your kiddies away to live among strangers, or let them stay with you. Maybe the Germans wouldn't come, but if they did, how would they behave to us? But come to that, what if they invaded England too? How would the children manage without their own families beside them? Do you know the state we were in when the Germans came? Shock is what I'd call it. The truth is, we didn't think they'd want us. It was England they were after, and we were of no use to them. We thought we'd be in the audience lake, not up on the stage itself. Then in the spring of 1940, Hitler got himself going through Europe like a hot knife through butter. Every place fell to him. It was so fast. Windows all over Guernsey shook and rattled from the explosions in France, and once the coast of France was gone, it was plain as day that England could not use up her men and ships to defend us. They needed to save them for when their own invasion began in earnest. So we were left to ourselves. In the middle of June, when it became pretty certain we were in for it, the States got on the telephone to London and asked if they would send ships for our children and take them to England. They could not fly, for fear of being shot down by the Luftwaffe. London said yes, but the children had to be ready at once. The ships would have to hurry here and back again while there was still time. It was such a desperate time for folks, and there was such a feel of Hurry, hurry. Jane had no more strength than a cat then, but she knew her mind. She wanted Eli to go. Other ladies were in a dither, go or stay, and they were wild to talk it over. But Jane told Elizabeth to keep them away. I don't want to hear them fuss, she said. It's bad for the baby. Jane had an idea that babies knew everything that happened around them, even before they were born. The time for dithering was soon over. Families had one day to decide, and 5 years to abide with it. School-aged children and babies with their mothers went first on the 19th and 20th of June. The states gave out pocket money to the kiddies, if their parents had none to spare. The littlest children were all excited about the sweets they could buy with it. Some thought it was like a Sunday school outing, and they'd be back by nightfall. They were lucky in that. The older children, like Eli, knew better. Of all the sights I saw the day they left, there is one picture I can't get out of my mind. Two little girls, all dressed up in pink party dresses, stiff petticoats, shiny strapped shoes, like their ma thought they'd be going to a party. How cold they must have been, crossing the channel. All the children were to be dropped off at their school by their parents. It was there we had to say our goodbyes. Buses came to take the children down to the pier. The boats that had just been to Dunkirk came back across the channel for the children. There was no time to get a convoy together to escort them. There was no time to get enough lifeboats on board, or life jackets. That morning we stopped first at the hospital for Eli to bid his mother goodbye. He couldn't do it. His jaw was clamped shut so tight, he could only nod. Jane held him for a bit, and then Elizabeth and me walked him down to the schoolyard. I hugged him hard, and that was the last time I saw him for 5 years. Elizabeth stayed because she had volunteered to help get the children inside ready. I was walking back to Jane in the hospital when I recalled something Eli had once said to me. He was about 5 years old, and we were walking down to Lac Gourbière to see the fishing boats come in. There was an old canvas bathing shoe left lying right in the middle of the path. Eli walked around it, staring. Finally, he said, "That shoe is all alone, Grandpa." I answered that yes, it was. He looked at it some more, and then we walked on by. After a bit, he said, "Grandpa, that's something I never am." I asked him, "What's that?" And he said, "Lonesome in my spirits." There, I had something happy to tell Jane after all, and I prayed it would stay true for him. Isola says she wants to write you herself of the doings inside the school. She says she was witness to a scene you will want to know about as an authoress. Elizabeth smacked Adelaide Addison in the face and made her leave. You do not know Miss Addison, and you are fortunate in that. She is a woman too good for daily wear. Isola told me you might come to visit Guernsey. I would be glad to offer you hospitality with me and Eli. Yours, Eben Ramsey.
Telegram from Juliet to Isola. Did Elizabeth really slap Adelaide Addison? If only I had been there. Please send details. Love, Juliet.
From Isola to Juliet. 24th of April, 1946. Dear Juliet. Yes, she did. Slapped her right across the face. It was lovely. We were all at the St. Briox School to help the children get ready for the buses to take them down to the ships. The states didn't want the parents to come into the school itself. Too crowded and too sad. Better to say goodbyes outside. One child crying might set them all off. So it was strangers who tied up shoelaces, wiped noses, put a name tag around each child's neck. We did up buttons and played games with them until the buses could come. I had one bunch of kiddies trying to touch their tongues to their noses, and Elizabeth had another bunch playing that game that teaches them how to lie with a straight face. I forget what it's called. When Adelaide Addison came in with that doleful mug of hers, all piety and no sense, she gathered a circle of children around her and commenced singing, "For those in peril on the sea," over their little heads. But no, safety from storms wasn't enough for her. God had to keep them from being blown up too. She set about ordering the poor things to pray for their parents every night. Who knew what the German soldiers might do to them? Then she said to be especially good little boys and girls, so that Mama and Daddy could look down on them from heaven and be proud of them. I tell you, Juliet, she had those children crying and sobbing fit to die. I was too shocked to move. But not Elizabeth. No, quick as an adder's tongue, she had a hold of Adelaide's arm and told her to shut up. Adelaide cried, "Let me go! I am speaking the word of God!" Elizabeth, she got a look on her that would turn the devil to stone, and then she slapped Adelaide right across the face, nice and sharp, so her head wobbled on her shoulders, and hauled her over to the door, shoved her out, and locked it. Old Adelaide kept a pounding on the door, but no one paid her any heed. I lie. Silly Daphne Post-it tried to open it, but I got around the neck and she stopped. It is my belief that the sight of a good fight shocked the fear right out of those babies, and they stopped crying, and the buses all came and we loaded the children on. Elizabeth and me, we didn't go home. We stood in the road and waved till the buses was out of sight. I hope I never live to see another such day, even with Adelaide getting slapped. All those little children bereft in the world. I was glad I did not have any. Thank you for your life story. You have had such sadness with your Ma and Pa, and your home by the river, for which things I am sorry. But me, I am glad you have dear friends like Sophie and her Ma and Sydney. As to that Sydney, he sounds a very fine man, but bossy. It's a failing common in men. Clovis Fossey has asked if you would send the Society a copy of your prize-winning essay on chickens. He thinks it would be nice to read aloud at a meeting. Then we could put it in our archives, if we ever have any. I'd like to read it too. Chickens being the reason I fell off a henhouse roof. They'd chased me there. How they all came at me, with their razor lips and back-to-back eyeballs. People don't know how chickens can turn on you, but they can, just like mad dogs. I didn't keep hens until the war came. Then I had to, but I am never easy in their company. I would rather have Ariel butt me on my bottom. That's open and honest, and not like a sly chicken sneaking up to jab you. I would like it if you would come to see us. So would Eben and Amelia and Dorsey, and Eli too. Kit is not so sure, but you needn't mind that. She might come round. Your newspaper article will be printed soon, so you could come here and rest up. It may be that you could find a story here you'd like to tell about. Your friend, Isola.
From Darcy to Juliet, the 26th of April, 1946. Dear Juliet, my temporary job at the quarry is over, and Kit is staying with me for a bit. She is sitting beneath the table I'm writing upon, whispering. "What's that you're whispering?" I asked, and there was a long quiet. Then she commenced whispering again, and I can make out my own name mixed into the other sounds. This is what generals call a war of nerves, and I know who is going to win. Kit doesn't resemble Elizabeth very much, except for her grey eyes, and a look she gets when she is concentrating hard. But she is like her mother inside, fierce in her feelings. Even when she was a tiny creature, it was so. She howled until the glass shivered in the windows, and when she gripped my finger in her little fist, it turned white. I knew nothing of babies, but Elizabeth made me learn. She said I was fated to be a father, and she had a responsibility to make sure I knew more than the usual run of them. She missed Christian, not just for herself, for Kit, too. Kit knows her father is dead. Amelia and I told her that, but we didn't know how to speak of Elizabeth. In the end, we said that she'd been sent away, and we hoped she'd return soon. Kit looked from me to Amelia and back, but she didn't ask any questions. She just went out and sat in the barn. I don't know if we did right. Some days I wear myself out with wishing for Elizabeth to come home. We have learned that Sir Ambrose Ivers was killed in one of the last bombing raids in London, and as Elizabeth inherited his estate, his solicitors have begun a search for her. They must have better ways to find her than we have, so I am hopeful that Mr. Dilwyn will get some word from her, or about her, soon. Wouldn't it be a blessed thing for Kit and for all of us, if Elizabeth could be found? The Society is having an outing on Saturday. We are attending the Guernsey Repertory Company's showing of Julius Caesar. John Booker is to be Mark Antony, and Clovis Fossey is going to play Caesar. Isola has been reading Clovis's lines, and she says we will all be astonished at his performance, especially when, after he's dead, he hisses, "Thou shalt see me at Philippi." Just thinking of the way Clovis hisses it has kept her awake for 3 nights, she says. Isola exaggerates, but only enough to enjoy herself. Kit stopped whispering. I've just peered under the table and she's asleep. It's later than I thought. Yours ever, Dawsey.
From Mark to Juliet, April 30th, 1946. Darling, just got in. The entire trip could have been avoided if Hendry had telephoned, but I smacked a few heads together and they've cleared the whole shipment through customs. I feel as though I've been away for years. Can I see you tonight? I need to talk to you. Love, M.
From Juliet to Mark. Of course. Do you want to come here? I have a sausage. Juliet.
From Mark to Juliet. A sausage? How appetizing. Suzette, at 8 o'clock? Love, M.
From Juliet to Mark. Say please. J.
From Mark to Juliet. Pleased to see you at Suzette at 8 o'clock. Love, M.
From Juliet to Mark. 1st of May, 1946. Dear Mark, I didn't refuse, you know. I said I wanted to think about it. You were so busy ranting about Sydney and Guernsey that perhaps you didn't notice. I only said I wanted time. I've known you 2 months. It's not long enough for me to be certain that we should spend the rest of our lives together, even if you are. I once made a terrible mistake and almost married a man I hardly knew. Perhaps you read about it in the papers. And at least in that case, the war was an extenuating circumstance. I won't be such a fool again. Think of it. I've never seen your home. I don't even know where it is, really. New York, but which street? What does it look like? What colour are your walls, your sofa? Do you arrange your books alphabetically? I hope not. Are your drawers tidy or messy? Do you ever hum? And if so, what? Do you prefer cats or dogs or fish? What on earth do you eat for breakfast? Or do you have a cook? You see, I don't know you well enough to marry you. I have one other piece of news that may interest you. Sydney is not your rival. I am not now, nor have I ever been in love with Sydney, nor he with me. Nor will I ever marry him. Is that decisive enough for you? Are you absolutely certain you wouldn't rather be married to someone more tractable than I? Juliet. From Juliet to Sophie, 1st of May, 1946. Dearest Sophie, I wish you were here. I wish we still lived together in our lovely little studio and worked in dear Mr. Hawke's shop and ate crackers and cheese for supper every night. I want so much to talk to you. I want you to tell me whether I should marry Mark Reynolds. He asked me last night. No bended knee, but a diamond as big as a pigeon egg at a romantic French restaurant. I'm not certain he still wants to marry me this morning. He's absolutely furious because I didn't give him an unequivocal yes. I tried to explain that I hadn't known him long enough and I needed time to think, but he wouldn't listen to me. He was certain that I was rejecting him because of a secret passion for Sydney. They really are obsessed with one another, those two. Thank God we were at his flat by then.
He began shouting about Sydney and godforsaken islands and women who care more about a passel of strangers than men who are right in front of them. That's Guernsey and my new friends there. I kept trying to explain, and he kept shouting until I began to cry from frustration. Then he felt remorseful, which was so unlike him and endearing that I almost changed my mind and said yes. But then I imagined a lifetime of having to cry to get him to be kind, and I went back to no again. We argued, and he lectured, and I wept a bit more because I was so exhausted, and eventually he called his chauffeur to take me home. As he shut me into the back seat, he leaned in to kiss me and said, "You're an idiot, Juliet." And maybe he's right. Do you recall those awful, awful Cheslane Fair novels we read the summer we were 13? My favourite was The Master of Blackheath. I must have read it 20 times, and so did you. Don't pretend you didn't. Do you remember Ransom? How he manfully hid his love for the girlish Eulalie so that she could choose freely, little knowing that she had been mad for him ever since she fell off her horse when she was 12. Here's the thing, Sophie. Mark Reynolds is exactly like Ransom. He's tall and handsome, with a crooked smile and a chiselled jaw. He shoulders his way through the crowd, careless of the glances that follow him. He's impatient and magnetic, and when I go to powder my nose, I overhear other women talking about him, just like Eulalie did in the museum. People notice him. He doesn't try to make them. They can't help it. I used to get shivers about Ransom. Sometimes I do about Mark, too, when I look at him. But I can't get over the nagging feeling that I'm no Eulalie. If I were ever to fall off a horse, it would be lovely to be picked up by Mark. But I don't think I'm likely to fall off a horse any time soon. I'm much more likely to go to Guernsey and write a book about the occupation, and Mark can't abide the thought. He wants me to stay in London and go to restaurants and theatres and marry him like a reasonable person. Write and tell me what to do. Love to Dominic, and you and Alexander as well. Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 3rd of May, 1946. Dear Sydney, I may not be as distraught as Stevens and Stark is without you, but I do miss you and want you to advise me. Please drop everything you are doing and write to me at once. I want to get out of London. I want to go to Guernsey. You know I've grown very fond of my Guernsey friends, and I'm fascinated by their lives under the Germans and afterward. I've visited the Channel Islands Refugee Committee and read their files. I've read the Red Cross reports. I've read all I can find on tote slave workers. There hasn't so far been much. I've interviewed some of the soldiers who liberated Guernsey and talked to Royal Engineers who removed the thousands of mines from their beaches. I've read all of the unclassified government reports on the state of the islanders' health, or lack of it, their happiness, or lack of it, their food supplies, or lack of them. But I want to know more. I want to know the stories of the people who were there, and I can never learn those by sitting in a library in London. For example, yesterday I was reading an article on the liberation. A reporter asked a Guernsey Islander, "What was the most difficult experience you had during the Germans' rule?" He made fun of the man's answer, but it made perfect sense to me. The islander told him, "You know they took away all of our wireless sets. If you were caught having a hidden radio, you'd get sent off to prison on the continent. Well, those of us who had secret radios, we heard about the Allies' landing in Normandy. Trouble was, we weren't supposed to know it had happened. Hardest thing I ever did was walk around St. Peterport on June the 7th, not grinning, not smiling, not doing anything to let those Germans know that I knew their end was coming. If they'd caught on, someone would be in for it. So we had to pretend. It was very hard to pretend not to know D-Day had happened." I want to talk to people like him, though he's probably off writers now, and hear about their war. For that's what I'd like to read, instead of statistics about grain. I'm not sure what form a book would take, or if I could even write one at all, but I would like to go to St. Peter Port and find out. Do I have your blessing? Love to you and Piers, Juliet.
Cable from Sydney to Juliet. 10th of May, 1946. Herewith my blessing. Guernsey is a wonderful idea, both for you and for a book. But will Reynolds allow it? Love, Sydney.
Cable from Juliet to Sydney, 11th of May, 1946. Blessing received. Mark Reynolds is not in a position to forbid or allow. Love, Juliet.
From Amelia to Juliet. 13th of May, 1946. My dear, it was a delight to receive your telegram yesterday and learn that you were coming to visit us. I followed your instructions and spread the news at once. You have sent the society into a whirlwind of excitement. The members instantly offered to provide you with anything you might need. Bed, board, introductions, a supply of electric clothespins. Isola is over the moon that you are coming and is already at work on behalf of your book. Though I cautioned her that it was only an idea as yet, she is bound and determined to find material for you. She has asked, perhaps threatened, everyone she knows in the market to send you letters about the occupation. She thinks you'll need them to persuade your publisher that the subject is bookworthy. Don't be surprised if you are inundated with mail in the next weeks. Isola also went to see Mr. Dilwyn at the bank this afternoon and asked him to offer you the rental of Elizabeth's cottage for your visit. It is a lovely sight, in a meadow below the big house, and it is small enough for you to manage easily. Elizabeth moved there when the German officers confiscated the larger house for their use. You would be very comfortable there, and Isola assured Mr. Dilwyn that he need only stir himself to draw up a lease for you. She herself will tend to everything else, airing out rooms, washing windows, beating rugs, and killing spiders. I hope you won't feel burdened by all these arrangements, as Mr. Dilwyn had planned to assess the property soon for its rental possibilities. Sir Ambrose's solicitors have begun an inquiry into Elizabeth's whereabouts. They have found there is no record of her arrival in Germany, only that she was put on a transport in France, with Frankfurt as the intended destination of the train. There will be further investigations, and I pray that they will lead to Elizabeth. But in the meantime, Mr. Dilwyn wants to rent the property left to Elizabeth by Sir Ambrose to provide income for Kit. I sometimes think that we are morally obliged to begin a search for Kit's German relations, but I cannot bring myself to do it. Christian was a rare soul, and he detested what his country was doing. But the same cannot be true for many Germans who believed in the dream of the Thousand-Year Reich. And how could we send our Kit away to a foreign and destroyed land, even if her relations could be found? We are the only family she's ever known. When Kit was born, Elizabeth kept her paternity a secret from the authorities, not out of shame, but because she was afraid that the baby would be taken from her and sent to Germany to be raised. There were dreadful rumours of such things. I wonder if Kit's heritage could have saved Elizabeth if she had made it known when she was arrested. But as she didn't, it is not my place to do so. Excuse my unburdening myself. My worries travel about my head on their well-worn path, and it is a relief to put them on paper. I will turn to more cheerful subjects, such as last evening's meeting of the society. After the uproar about your visit had subsided, the society read your article about books and reading in the Times. Everyone enjoyed it. Not just because we were reading about ourselves, but because you brought us views we'd never thought to apply to our reading before. Dr. Stubbins pronounced that you alone had transformed distraction into an honourable word instead of a character.